Agger.
So, he asked, what do we do now, Col?
The wounded man shrugged. Ease the girl's mind, I guess. From the looks of it, she needs some help.
But she killed Chert, Croker stated. I saw the blood on her knife.
Col squinted at the girl. I don't doubt you, boy, but this girl doesn't look capable of killing anyone.
You think I can't see that? Croker said. I'm just telling you what I saw. I know it doesn't make any sense.
Col sighed. Anyway, she still needs our help, so go and get her, Crocus. The boy threw up his hands.
How do I do that?
Damned if I know, Col replied, grinning. Try flirting. Crocus threw the man a disgusted look. Then he walked cautiously toward the girl. She tensed and backed a step.
Careful,
Crocus cried, pointing at the summit's crest behind her. The girl saw that she stood at the very edge of a steep slope. Oddly enough, this seemed to relax her. She moved a few steps closer to Crocus, her wide eyes searching his.
That's right, Crocus murmured. Everything's fine. Do you understand?
He pointed at his mouth and made talking motions. Col groaned. The girl surprised them both by replying in Daru.
I understand you, she said haltingly. More now. You're not Malazan. You're not speaking Malazan. But I understand you, she frowned. How?
Malazan, huh? Col said. Where are you from, girl? She thought for a moment.
Itgokan, she said.
What? Col laughed. What storm blew you here? Realization flooded her eyes.
Where's my father? What happened to the nets? I bought the twine, and there was that seer. Rigolai the seer, the wax witch. I remember her. She died.
The girl fell to her knees.
She died, and then...
Cole's expression was severe, thoughtful. And then...
I don't remember,
the girl whispered, looking down at her hands.
I don't remember anything more.
She began to cry. Get a round thousand teats, Col cursed quietly, waving Crocus to his side. Listen carefully, lad. Don't wait for us. Take this girl to your uncle. Take her to Mammut, and quickly. Crocus scowled.
Why? I can't just leave you here, Col. Who knows when Murillo and Crupper will come around? What if that mercenary comes back?
What if she does? Col asked pointedly. Crocus flushed and looked away. Murillo's a tough bastard, despite the perfume, Col said. He'll be up and dancing in no time. Take the girl to your uncle, lad. Do as I say.
You still haven't told me why, Crocus said.
It's a hunch, no more. Col reached up and gripped the boy's shoulder. This girl's been possessed. I think. Someone, something, brought her here, to Darujistan and onto our trail. The truth is somewhere in her head, Crocus, and it could be vital. Your uncle knows the right people. They can help her, lad. Now, saddle up my horse. I'll wait here for our friends to wake. Hood knows I can't walk anyway. I shouldn't move for at least a couple of days. Cropper and Marilia will handle things here. Go! Crocus eyed the weeping girl. Then he said,
All right, Col. We'll go back, me and her.
Good, Col grunted. Now, lay me out a bedroll and some food. Then ride on out of here. And if that damn horse of mine has a heart attack outside the city gates, even better. Hop to it, lad. Chapter 16 Decembri knows the sorrows in our souls. He walks at the side of each mortal, a vessel of regret on the fires of vengeance. Decembri knows the sorrows and would now share them with us all. The Lord of Tragedy, Holy Book Prayer, Canon of Casale. The puncture wound in Lorne's left shoulder was not deep. Without magical aid, however, the risk of infection was a cause for concern. She returned to the camp to find Toole still positioned where he had been since dawn. Ignoring the eye mass, the adjunct found her collection of herbs in her saddlebag. She sat down and leaned back against the saddle, then set to treating the wound. It had been a foolish, unnecessary attack. Too many things had happened recently, too many ideas, too much of the woman Lorne interfering with her functions and duties as adjunct to the Empress. She was making mistakes that she would not have made a year ago. Toole had given her more to think about than she could handle. The words the eye mass had thrown at her feet, as if in afterthought, had reached into and grasped something deep within her, and now would not let go. Emotions seeped into the adjunct, clouding the world around her. She had abandoned sorrow long ago, along with regret. Compassion was anathema to the adjunct. Yet now all these feelings swept through her in tides, pulling her every which way. She found herself clinging to the title of adjunct and what it meant, as if it was a lifeline to sanity, to stability and control. She completed cleaning the wound as best she could, then prepared a poultice. Control. The word rebounded in her thoughts, clipped, hard and sure. What was the heart of empire, if not control? What shaped Empress Lassine's every act, her every thought? And what had been at the heart of the very first empire, the great wars that shaped the Talan Eye Mass to this day? She sighed and looked down at the dirt beneath her. But that was no more than we all sought, she told herself. From a young girl bringing twine home to her father, to the immortal power that had seized her for its own use.
Through the gamut of life, we struggled for control, for a means to fashion the world around us. An eternal, hopeless hunt for the privilege of being able to predict the shape of our lives.
The Eye Mass and his 300,000-year-old words had given to Lorne a sense of futility. And it worked on her. It threatened to overwhelm her. She had given the boy his life, surprising both him and herself. Lorne smiled ruefully. Prediction had become a privilege now lost to her. Never mind the outside world, she could not even guess her own actions or the course of her thoughts. Was this the true nature of emotion, she wondered? The great defier of logic, of control, the whims of being human. What lay ahead? Adjunct? Startled, Lorne looked up to see Toole standing over her. Frost covered the warrior, steaming in the heat.
You have been wounded.
A skirmish, she said gruffly, almost embarrassed. It's over now.
She pressed the poultice against the wound, then wrapped cloth around her shoulder. It was an awkward effort, since she could use only one hand. Toole knelt beside her.
I will assist you, adjunct.
Surprised, Lorne studied the warrior's death's face, but his next words wiped out any thoughts of the eye mass revealing compassion.
We have little time, adjunct. The opening awaits us.
An expressionless mask settled over her face. She jerked a nod as Toole finished, his withered, shredded hands, his nails blunt, polished brown and curved, deftly tying a knot with the strips of cloth.
Help me to my feet, she commanded.
The marker had been shattered, she saw, as the eye mass guided her forward. Apart from this, however, all looked unchanged.
Where is this opening? She asked.
Toole halted before the broken stones.
I will lead, adjunct. Follow closely behind me. When we are within the tomb, Unsheath your sword. The deadening effect will be minimal, yet it will slow the Jaghat's return to consciousness. Enough for us to complete our efforts.
Lorne drew a deep breath. She shrugged off her doubts. There was no turning back now. Had there ever been such a chance? The question, she realized, was a moot one. The course had been chosen for her.
Very well, she said. Lead on, Tool.
The Imas spread out his arms to the sides. The hillside before them blurred, as if a curtain of wind-blown sand rose before it. A churning wind roiled through this strange mist. Tool stepped forward. Following, Lorne at first recoiled at the stench that wafted into her, a stench of air poisoned by centuries of pulsing sorcery, countless wards dispersed by Tool's Telan powers. She pushed ahead, her eyes fixing on the Imas's broad, tattered back. They entered the hillside. A rough corridor leading into darkness appeared before them. Frost limned the stacked boulders forming the walls and ceiling. As they went farther, the air grew bitter cold, stripped of scents, and thick green and white ropes of ice tracked the walls. The floor, which had been frozen-packed earth, became slabs of stone, slick with ice. Numbness seeped into Lorne's extremities and her face. She saw her breath curl in a white stream, drawn inward to the darkness beyond. The corridor narrowed, and she saw strange symbols painted on and within the ice, streaking the walls, dull red ochre in color. These markings brushed something deep inside her. She almost recognized them. But as soon as she concentrated on doing so, the sensation of familiarity vanished. Tool spoke.
My people have visited here before, he said, pausing to look at the adjunct over one shoulder. They added their own wards to those of the Jaghat who imprisoned this tyrant.
Lorne was irritated.
What of it?
The Imas stared at her in silence, then replied dully,
Adjunct, I believe I know the name of this Jaghat tyrant. I am now beset by doubts. It should not be freed. Yet, like you, I am compelled.
Lorne's breath caught.
Adjunct, Tool continued, I acknowledge the ambivalence you have been feeling. I share it. When this is done, I shall leave.
She was confused.
Leave?
Tool nodded.
Within this tomb, and with what we will do, my vows are ended. They will bind me no longer. Such is the residual power of this sleeping Jaghat. And for that, I am thankful.
Why are you telling me this?
Adjunct, you are welcome to accompany me.
Lorne opened her mouth, but could think of no immediate reply, so shut it again.
I ask that you consider my offer, adjunct. I shall journey in search of an answer, and I shall find it.
Answer? To what?
She wanted to ask. Yet something stopped her, a surge of fear that said to her, You don't want to know. Remain ignorant in this.
Let's get on with it, she grated.
Tool resumed his march into the darkness. After a minute, Lorne asked,
How much time is this going to take?
Time?
There was amusement in his voice.
Within this barrow, adjunct, time does not exist. The Jaghat who imprisoned their kin brought an age of ice to this land, the barrow's final seal. Adjunct, a half league of ice stands over this burial chamber. Still, we have come to a time and place before the faltering of the Jaghat ice, before the coming of the great inland sea known to the Aimas as Jagratil, before the passing of countless ages.
And when we return,
Lorne interrupted,
how much time will have passed?
I cannot say, Adjunct.
The Aimas paused and turned back to her, his eye sockets glimmering with a sourceless light.
I have never done this before.
Despite the hardened leather armor, the feel of a woman pressing against Crocus's back had brought to his face more sweat than the afternoon heat could account for. Yet it was a mix of feelings that had his heart thumping against his chest. On the one hand was the bald fact that here was a girl of nearly his age, and an attractive one at that, with surprisingly strong arms wrapped around his waist and her warm, moist breath on his neck. On the other hand, this woman had murdered a man, and the only reason he could think of her arriving on the scene back there in the hills was that she'd been planning to kill him too. So he found himself too tense to enjoy sharing the saddle with her. They had said little to each other since leaving Kol. In another day, Crocus knew, Darujistan's walls would come into view. He wondered if she'd remember it. And then a voice spoke in his head that sounded like Kol's.
Why don't you ask the girl, idiot?
Crocus scowled. She spoke first.
Is it Kokan far from here?
He thought about laughing, but something, an instinct, stopped him. Tread softly, he told himself.
I've never heard of such a place, he said. It's in the Malasan Empire? Yes. We aren't in the Empire.
Crocus growled.
Not yet.
Then his shoulders slumped.
We're on a continent called Genabakis. The Malasans came from the seas, both east and west. They now control all the free cities to the north, as well as the Nathilog Confederacy. Oh,
the girl replied weakly.
You're at war with the Empire, then?
More or less, though you'd never know it as far as Darujistan is concerned.
Is that the name of the town you live in?
Town? Darujistan's a city. It's the biggest, richest city in all the land. There was awe and excitement in her reply.
A city? I've never been to a city. Your name is Crocus, isn't it?
How did you know that?
That's what your soldier friend called you.
Oh, of course. Why did the fact that she'd known his name send his heart lurching?
Aren't you going to ask me my name?
The woman asked quietly.
You can remember it?
No,
she admitted.
That's strange, isn't it?
He heard pathos in that reply, and something melted inside, making him even angrier.
Well, I can't very well help you in that, can I?
The woman seemed to withdraw behind him, and her arms loosened their grip.
No.
Abruptly, his anger fell away. Crocus was ready to scream at the chaos in his head. Instead, he shifted in the saddle, forcing her to clutch him tightly.
Ah, he smirked. That's better.
Then his eyes widened.
What am I saying?
He thought.
Crocus?
What?
Give me a Darujistan name. Pick one. Pick your favorite.
Shalice, he responded immediately. No, wait. You can't be Shalice. I already know a Shalice. You've got to be someone else.
Is she your girlfriend?
No,
he snapped. He pulled at the reins and they stopped. Crocus clawed at his hair, then threw a leg over and dropped to the ground. He pulled the reins over the horse's head.
I want to walk, he said.
Yes, she said. I would like to, too.
Well, maybe I want to run.
She stepped round to face him, her expression troubled.
Run? From me, Crocus?
He saw things falling into ruins behind her eyes. What were those things? He felt a desperate need to know, but asking straight out was clearly impossible. Why it was impossible, he couldn't say. It just was. He looked down at the ground and kicked at a rock. "No," he mumbled. "I didn't mean that. Sorry." Her eyes widened.
"That was my name," she gasped. "That was my name, Crocus. You just said my name."
"What?" he frowned. "Sorry?"
"Yes."
She looked away.
"Only it wasn't always my name. I don't think. No, it wasn't the name my father gave me."
"Can you remember that one?" She shook her head and ran a hand through her long, dark hair. Crocus started walking, and the girl fell into step beside him. The road wound down through the low hills. In an hour, they'd reached the Catlin Bridge. The panic that had filled him was subsiding, perhaps having burned itself out. He felt relaxed, and that surprised him, since he couldn't recall the last time he had felt relaxed in a female's company. They walked in silence for a time. Ahead, the sun sank down in a golden blaze, shimmering along a blue and green line on the horizon beyond the hills. Crocus pointed to the glistening line. "That's Lake Azure. Darujasan lies on its south shore."
"Haven't you thought of a name for me yet?" the woman asked.
"The only name that comes to mind," Crocus said sheepishly, "is my matron's." The girl glanced at him.
"Your mother's?"
Crocus laughed.
"No, not that kind of matron. I meant the Lady of Thieves, Apsala. Only it's not good to take that kind of name, since she's a goddess. What about Sala?"
Her nose wrinkled.
"No, I like Apsala. Make it Apsala." "But I just said, that's the name I want,"
the girl insisted, her face darkening. "Uh-oh," Crocus thought. "Better not press this one."
"All right,"
he sighed.
"So you're a thief?"
"What's wrong with that?" Apsala grinned.
"Given my new name, nothing. Nothing at all, Crocus. When do we camp?"
He blanched. He hadn't thought about that.
"Maybe we should just push on," he said warily, not meeting her eyes.
"I'm tired. Why don't we camp at this Catlin Bridge?"
"Well, I've only got the one bedroll. You can have it. I'll stand watch."
"All night? What's there to watch out for?"
Crocus rounded on her.
"Why all these questions?" he demanded hotly. "It's dangerous out here. Didn't you see Cole's wound? And how do we know the garrison's still there?"
"What garrison?"
Crocus cursed himself. He averted his gaze.
"The garrison on the other side of the bridge," he said. "But it's a long bridge."
"Oh, come on, Crocus,"
Apsala laughed and drove her elbow into his ribs.
"We'll share the bedroll. I don't mind, so long as you keep your hands to yourself."
Rubbing his ribs, Crocus could only stare at her. Cursing, Cropper glared over his shoulder at Murillo.
"Damnation! Can't you urge that beast any faster?"
The mule was living up to its reputation, refusing anything but a plodding walk. Murillo grinned sheepishly.
"What's the big hurry, Cropper? The boy can take care of himself." "It was Master Baruch's explicit command that we guard him, and guard him we must."
Murillo's eyes narrowed.
"So you keep saying," he muttered. "Is this some favor on Mammoth's behalf? Has the boy's uncle got all worried all of a sudden? Why is Baruch so interested in Crocus? You convey the alchemist's orders, Cropper, but you don't explain them."
Cropper reined in his mount.
"Oh, very well," he said. "Mutiny in the ranks forces Cropper's sly hand. Opon has chosen Crocus, for whatever purpose the devious deity may devise. Baruch would have us keep an eye on the lad, and more, prevent any other powers from finding him."
Murillo rubbed the bruise on his forehead and winced.
"Damn you," he sighed.
You should have explained all this from the start, Crupper. Does Ralik know?
Of course not, Crupper replied tartly. He's too busy, after all, unable to extricate himself from his various responsibilities. Hence,
Crupper's expression turned crafty,
the assassin's absence on this journey. But why, pray tell, is Crupper informing Murillo of such things? Clearly, Murillo knows more of Ralik's doings than poor, ignorant Crupper.
Murillo's look was blank.
What do you mean?
Crupper sniggered, then kicked his mule into motion once again. Murillo followed.
And as for our present mission, Crupper continued blithely, what seems a vast failure, particularly on Cole's part, is, in truth, an astonishing success. Master Baruch must be made aware of the nefarious activities afoot in the Gadrubi Hills.
Success? What are you talking about?
Crupper waved a hand.
Dear man, though I was conscious but a moment during the fracas, clear it was that this woman warrior possessed an Otaterral sword, which means, as any child might guess, she's Malazan.
Murillo hissed slowly between his teeth.
And we left Cole back there? Are you insane, Crupper?
He'll mend enough to follow us shortly, Crupper said. The need for haste overwhelms all other considerations.
Except cheap deals with a certain stabler, Murillo growled. So, there's some Malazan in the Gadrubi Hills. What's she up to? And don't try telling me you don't know. If you didn't suspect something, we wouldn't be in such a hurry.
Suspicions indeed,
Crupper nodded, his shoulders hunching.
Recall Crocus uttering that perceptive comment as we left the crossroads? Hunting a rumor or some such thing?
Wait a minute, Murillo groaned. Not that Barrow legend again. There's not a...
Crupper held up a finger and cut in smoothly.
What we believe is irrelevant, Murillo. The fact remains that the Malazans are seeking the truth of that rumor, and both Crupper and Master Baruch suspect, being of equal intelligence, that they might well discover it. Hence this mission, my fluttery friend.
He waggled his brows.
Otaterral in the hands of a swordmaster of the Empire. A Talan Imas lurking in the vicinity. What?
Murillo exploded, his eyes wide. He made to turn his mule around, but the beast complained and planted its hooves. He struggled with it, cursing.
Cole's all cut up, and he's got a Malazan killer out there and an Imas. You've lost your mind, Crupper.
But, dear Murillo,
Crupper crooned,
Crupper would have thought you eager, nay, desperate to return to Daruzistan as quickly as possible.
That stopped the man. He rounded on Crupper, face darkening.
Come on,
he gritted.
Out with it, then.
Crupper's brows rose.
Out with what?
You've been hinting about something, poking me with it. So if you think you know something about whatever, let's hear it. Otherwise, we turn round right now and head back to Cole.
Seeing Crupper's eyes dart, Murillo grinned.
Ha! You thought to distract me, didn't you? Well, it's not going to work.
Crupper raised his hands palm up.
No matter whose brain was responsible for your scheme to return Cole to his rightful title, Crupper can do naught but eagerly applaud.
Murillo's jaw dropped.
How in Hood's name did Crupper?
The man continued.
But all that is inconsequential when faced with the fact of Crocus and the grave danger he is presently in. More, if this young girl was indeed possessed, as Cole suspects, the risks are frightening to behold. Was she the only hunter for the lad's frail, unprotected life? What of the thousand gods and demons who would eagerly confound Opon at the first opportunity? Thus would Murillo, friend of long standing with Crocus, so callously abandon the child to the fates? Is Murillo a man to succumb to panic? To what-ifs? To a host of imagined nightmares, slinking about within the shadows of his overwrought imagination?
All right, Murillo barked. Now, hold your tongue and let's ride.
Crupper gave a brusque nod at this wise remark. An hour later, as dusk clambered up the hillsides and ever westward to the dying sun, Murillo started and threw Crupper a furious glare that was lost in the gloom.
Damn him, he whispered. I said I wasn't about to let him distract me. So what's the first thing he does? Distract me.
Murillo murmur something?
Crupper asked.
Murillo massaged his forehead.
I'm having dizzy spells, he said. Let's find a camp. Crocus and the girl won't make it to the city before tomorrow anyway. I doubt he's in any danger on the road, and we'll find him easily enough before tomorrow's sunset. They should be fine in the daytime. Who knows? They'll be with Mammoth, right?
Crupper admits to his own weariness. Indeed, a camp should be found, and Murillo can construct a small fire, perhaps, and so prepare dinner, while Crupper ponders vital thoughts and such.
Fine,
Murillo sighed.
Just fine.
It came to Captain Parron a couple of days after his encounter with the Tista Andii and the events within the Lord's Sword that Rake had not suspected him to be a Malazan soldier. Or he'd be dead. Oversight blessed him, it seemed. His assassin in pale should have checked twice. And now the Son of Darkness, snatching him from the jaws of the hounds, had in turn let him walk free. Was there a pattern to this? It had Opon's flavor, yet Parron didn't doubt Rake's assertion. Then did his luck indeed lie in his sword? And had these mercies of fortune marked pivotal moments, moments that would come back to haunt those who'd spared him? For his own well-being, he hoped not. His was no longer the Empire's road. He'd walked that path of blood and treachery for too long. Never again. What lay before him, then, was the singular effort to save the lives of Whiskey Jack and the squad. If he managed that, he would not begrudge his own death as a consequence. Some things went beyond a single man's life, and maybe justice existed outside the minds of humanity. Beyond even the hungry eyes of gods and goddesses, a thing shining and pure and final. Some philosophers he'd read during his schooling in the Malazan capital, Unta, had asserted what seemed to him then an absurd position. Morality was not relative, they claimed, nor even existing solely in the realm of the human condition. No, they proclaimed morality as an imperative of all life, a natural law that was neither the brutal acts of beasts, nor the lofty ambitions of humanity, but something other, something unassailable. Just another hunt for certainty, he thought. Parron scowled and stiffened in his saddle, his eyes fixed on the trader track winding before him through low, rounded hills. He recalled discussing this with Adjunct Lorne, at a time when neither had been compelled by the outside world. Just another hunt for certainty, she had said, in a voice brittle and cynical, putting an end to the discussion as clearly as if she had driven a knife into the wine-stained table between them. For such words to have come from a woman no older than him, Parron suspected then, as he did now, that her particular view had been no more than an easy, lazy mimicry of Empress Lassine's. But Lassine had a right to it, and Lorne did not. At least in Parron's mind. If anyone had a right to world-weary cynicism, it was the Empress of the Malazan Empire. Truly had the adjunct made herself Lassine's extension. But at what cost? He'd seen the young woman behind the mask just once, as they'd looked out over a road carpeted with dead soldiers, then proceeded to pick their way through them. The pale, frightened girl that was Lorne had shown herself in a single, frail moment. He couldn't remember what had triggered the return of the mask.
Likely it had been something he'd said, something he'd tossed off in his own guise as a hardened soldier. Perrin sighed deeply. Too many regrets, he thought. Lost chances, and with each one passing, the less human we all became, and the deeper into the nightmare of power we all sank. Was his life irretrievable? He wished he had an answer to that question. Movement in the south caught his attention, and with it he became aware of a rumbling sound, rising up from the earth around him. He rose in the saddle. A wall of dust curled over the ridge of land directly ahead. He swung his mount westward and nudged it into a trot. Moments later, he reined in. The curtains of dust hung in that direction as well. Cursing, he spurred to the crest of a nearby rise. Dust. Dust on all sides. A storm? He thought. No, the thunder is too regular. He rode down to the plain below and reined in again, wondering what to do. The dust wall rose, cresting the hill he faced. The deep rumbling grew. Perrin squinted into the dust. Dark, massive shapes moved there, spreading out to either side, sweeping down on his position. In moments, he was surrounded. Bedouin. He had heard tales of the huge, shaggy creatures moving across the inner plains in herds half a million strong. On all sides, Perrin could see nothing but the humped, reddish-brown, dust-caked backs of the beasts. There was nowhere he could lead his horse, no place of safety within sight. Perrin leaned back in his saddle and waited. Something flashed to his left, tawny and low to the ground. The captain half turned, just as something heavy hammered him from the right and clung, dragging him from the saddle. Cursing, Perrin thumped heavily in the dust, grappling with wiry limbs, ragged black hair. He drove his knee up, connecting with a solid stomach. His attacker rolled to one side, gasping. Perrin scrambled to his feet, found himself facing a youth in tanned hides. The boy sprang to close with the captain once again. Perrin sidestepped and clouted the boy on the side of the head. His attacker sprawled unconscious. Piercing cries were sounding on all sides. The Bedouin were parting, moving away. Figures emerged, closing on Perrin's position. Rivi, sworn enemies to the Empire, allied in the north with Caladan Brood and the Crimson Guard. Two warriors came to the unconscious boy's side. Each took an arm and dragged him off. The herd had come to a stop. Another warrior approached, striding boldly up to Perrin. His dust-streaked face was stitched with dyed threads, black and red, from high on the cheeks down to the jawline, then up and around the mouth. A Bedouin hide rode the broad line of his shoulders. Stopping less than an arm's length in front of Perrin, the warrior reached out and closed his hand on the grip of chance. Perrin struck away the hand. The Rivi smiled, stepped back, and loosed a high-pitched, ululating cry. Figures rose on the backs of the surrounding Bedouin, lances balanced in one hand, as they crouched on the shaggy backs. The huge animals beneath the warriors ignored them as if they were but tick birds. The two Rivi who had taken the boy away now returned, joining the stitched-faced warrior, who said something to the one on his left. This man moved forward. Before Perrin could react, he surged into motion, throwing a leg behind the captain, then driving his shoulder into Perrin's chest. The warrior fell on top of him. A knife blade slid against the line of Perrin's jaw, sliced through the helmet strap. The iron skullcap was pulled away, and fingers snagged a handful of his hair. Dragging the warrior with him, Perrin pushed himself upright. He had had enough. Death was one thing, death without dignity quite another. As the Rivi's hand twisted, pulling his head up, the captain reached between the warrior's legs and found his own handful. He yanked hard. The warrior shrieked, releasing Perrin's hair. A knife appeared again, flashing at the captain's face. He ducked to one side, his free hand snapping up to grasp the wrist, pushing away the knife. He squeezed once more with his other hand. The rivie shrieked again, then Perrin let go, twisted round, and drove his armored elbow into the man's face. Blood splattered like rain in the dust. The warrior reeled back, crumpled to the ground. A lance haft hammered a glancing blow along Perrin's temple. He spun round with the impact. A second lance struck him in the hip, hard as a kick from a horse, numbing his leg. Something pinned his left foot to the ground. Perrin unsheathed Chance. The weapon was almost knocked from his hand with a ringing, pealing sound. He swung it upward, and it was struck again. Half-blinded with pain, sweat, and dust, Perrin reared upright, shifting to a two-handed grip and drawing Chance down to a center guard position. The sword's blade was struck a third time, but he retained his grip. There was silence. Gasping, blinking, Perrin raised his head, looked around. Rivie surrounded him, but none moved. Their dark eyes were wide. Perrin flicked his gaze to his weapon, glared back up and around at the warriors, then his eyes returned to Chance, and stayed there. Three iron lance heads sprouted from the blade like leaves, each point split and jammed, the hafts shattered and gone, leaving only white wood jutting out from the sockets. He looked down at his pinned foot. A lance had struck through his boot, but the wide blade of the head was turned, its flat side pressing against his foot. Splintered wood surrounded him. Perrin glanced at his hip, saw no wound. A jagged tear marred the leather of Chance's scabbard. The rivie warrior with the smashed face lay motionless a few feet from where Perrin stood. The captain saw that his mount and the pack horses were untouched and had not moved. The other rivie had pulled back. The encirclement now divided as a small figure approached. A girl, perhaps no more than 5 years old. The warriors moved aside from her as if in awe or fear, possibly both. She wore antelope skins tied with cord at the waist, and nothing on her feet. There was something familiar about her, a way of walking, her stance as she stopped before him. Something in her heavy-lidded eyes that made Perrin frown uneasily. The girl stopped to regard him, her small round face slowly coming to mirror Perrin's own frown. She raised one hand, as if reaching for him, then dropped it. The captain found he could not pull away his eyes from her. "Child, do I know you?" he thought. As the silence between them lengthened, an old woman came up behind the girl, rested a wrinkled hand on her shoulder. Looking worn, almost exasperated, the old woman studied the captain. The girl beside her said something, the quick, lilting language of the rivie, surprisingly low-pitched for one so young. The old woman crossed her arms. The girl spoke again, insistently. The old woman addressed Perrin in Daru.
"Five lances claimed you as our enemy," she paused. "Five lances were wrong."
"You've plenty more," Perrin said.
"So we have, and the god favoring your sword has no followers here."
"So finish it," Perrin growled. "I'm tired of the game." The girl spoke, a tone of command that rang like iron on stone. The old woman turned in obvious surprise. The girl continued, her words now evidently explanatory. The old woman listened, then swung her dark, glittering gaze back to the captain.
"You are Malazan, and Malazans have chosen to be the enemies of the rivie. Is this choice yours as well? And know this, I will recognize a lie when I hear it."
"I am Malazan by birth," Perrin said. "I have no interest in calling the rivie my enemy. I would rather have no enemies at all."
The old woman blinked.
She offers you words to ease your grief, soldier.
Meaning?
You are to live.
Perrin did not quite trust this turn of events.
What words has she for me? I've never seen her before.
Nor has she seen you before. Yet you know each other.
No, we don't.
The old woman's eyes hardened.
Will you hear her words or not? She offers you a gift. Will you throw it back in her face?
Profoundly uneasy, he said,
No, I suppose not.
The child says you need not grieve. The woman you know has not passed through the arching trees of death. Her journey was beyond the lands you can see, beyond those of the spirit that all mortals sense. And now she has returned. You must be patient, soldier. You will meet again, so this child promises.
Which woman? Perrin demanded, his heart pounding.
The one you thought dead.
He looked again at the girl. The familiarity returned like a blow to his chest. He staggered back a step.
Not possible.
He whispered. The girl withdrew, dust swirling. She vanished.
Wait!
Another cry sounded. The herd lurched into motion, closing in, obscuring the rivi. In moments, all Perrin could see were the backs of the giant beasts, shuffling past. He thought to push among them, but knew it would bring him only death.
Wait!
The captain shouted again. But the sound of hundreds, thousands of hooves on the plain drowned his efforts.
Tattersail!
It was fully an hour before the Bedouin herd's tail end appeared. As the last of the beasts strolled past the captain, he looked around. The wind rolled the dust cloud eastward, over the sloping, humped hills. Perrin climbed into the saddle, swung his mount southward once again. The hills of Gardrobi rose before him.
Tattersail, what did you do?
He thought. He recalled Tok noting the trail of small prints leading from the scorched pillar that had been all that was left of Belladan and Tattersail.
Hood's breath! Did you plan such a thing? And why the rivi? Reborn? Already a child of 5, maybe 6? Are you even mortal anymore, woman? Have you ascended? You found yourself a people, a strange primitive people. To what end? And when we next meet, how old will you appear to be then?
He thought again about the rivi. They'd been driving the herd north, a herd big enough to feed.
An army on the march. Caladan Brood. He's on his way to Pale. That is something I don't think Duchek's prepared for. Old One Arm's in trouble.
He had another 2 hours of riding before sunset. Beyond the Gardrobi Hills was Lake Azure and the city of Darujistan. And within the city, Whiskey Jack and his squad.
And in that squad, a young woman I've been preparing to meet for 3 years, he thought. The god possessing her. Is he even my enemy anymore?
The question arrived unbidden, turning his heart cold.
Gods, what a journey this has been.
And here I had thought to travel this plain unnoticed.
A foolish thought. Scholars and mages write endlessly of fell convergences. It seems I am a walking convergence, a lodestone to draw ascendance. To their peril, it seems. My sword's chance answered those 5 lances, despite my treatment of one of the twins. How to explain that?
The truth is, my cause has become my own. Not the adjuncts. Not the empires. I said I'd rather have no enemies at all. And the old woman saw those as true words. And so it seems they are. Endless surprises, Ganawiz Perrin. Ride on. see what comes.
The track climbed a hillside, and the captain spurred his horse up the slope. Reaching the summit, he yanked hard on the reins. The horse snorted indignantly and swung her head round, eyes rolling. But Perrin's attention was elsewhere. He leaned back in the saddle and loosened his sword. A heavily armored man struggled to his feet beside a small campfire. Beyond him was a hobbled mule. The man tottered, his weight on one leg, and unsheathed a bastard sword, which he then leaned on as he regarded the captain. Perrin nudged his mount forward, scanning the immediate area. It seemed that the warrior was alone. He brought his horse to a halt, with 30 feet between them. The man spoke in Daru.
"I'm in no shape for a fight, but if you want one, it's yours."
Once again, Perrin found himself thankful for the adjunct's insistence that he be thoroughly schooled. His reply was as fluent as this native's.
"No, I've lost the taste for it."
He waited, leaning forward in the saddle, then grinned at the mule.
"Is that beast a war mule?"
The man barked a laugh.
"I'm sure it thinks it is," he said, relaxing. "I've food to spare, traveller, if you're of a mind."
The captain dismounted and approached.
"My name's Perrin," he said.
He sat down by the fire. The other followed suit. The fire between them.
"Cull," he grunted, stretching out a bandaged leg. "You down from the north?"
"Genobaris, initially. Spent some time in Pale recently." Cull's brows rose at that.
"You've the look of a mercenary," he said, "though likely an officer. I heard it was pretty bad up there."
"I arrived a little late," Perrin admitted. "Saw lots of rubble and lots of dead, so I'm inclined to believe the stories." He hesitated, then said, "There was a rumor in Pale that Moonspawn is now over Darujistan." Cull grunted, tossing a handful of sticks onto the fire.
"So it is," he said.
He gestured at a battered pot tucked against the coals.
"That's stew, if you're hungry. Help yourself."
Perrin realized he was famished. He accepted Cole's offer gratefully. As he ate, using a wooden spoon the man loaned him, he thought to ask about that leg wound. But then he recalled his claw training. When you play a soldier, you play it to the hilt. Nobody talks about what's obvious. Something staring you in the eye, you look around it and grumble about the weather. Anything important will come out in its own time. Soldiers have nothing to look forward to, making patience an easy virtue. And sometimes it's not just a virtue, but a contest of indifference. So Perrin emptied the pot, while Cole waited in casual silence, poking at the fire and adding the occasional stick from an enormous pile behind him. Where the wood had come from was anybody's guess. Finally, Perrin wiped his mouth with his sleeve and scrubbed the spoon as clean as he could manage without water. He sat back and belched. Cole spoke.
"You heading into Darujistan, then?"
"I am. And you?"
"Should be able to manage it in another day or so, though I can't say I'm looking forward to riding into the city on the back of a mule."
Perrin looked westward.
"Well," he said, squinting, "sun's about down. Mind if I share this camp for the night?"
"By all means." The captain rose and attended to his horses. He thought about delaying a day to let this man mend some more, then lending him a horse. If he rode into the city in the company of a local, there'd be advantages. Someone to direct him, perhaps even give him a place to stay for a day or two. Not only that, but he might learn something in the meantime. Would another day matter? Possibly, but it looked worth it. He hobbled the wicken horses near the mule, then carried his saddle back to the fire.
"Been thinking about your problem," Perrin said, as he dropped the saddle and sat with his back against it. "I'll ride in with you. You can use my pack horse."
Cole's eyes were alert.
"A generous offer."
Seeing the man's suspicion, Perrin smiled. The horses could use the extra day's rest, for one. Second,
I've never before been to Jerujistan, so in exchange for my so-called generosity, I'd like to plague you with endless questions in the next 2 days. After that, I get my horse back, and you're on your way. And if anyone's come out ahead, it's me.
Better warn you now, Perrin. I'm not much of a talker.
I'll take the risk.
Col considered for a time.
Good knows, he said. I'd be mad not to accept, wouldn't I? You don't look the type to stick me in the back. I don't know your real story, Perrin. If that's something you want to keep to yourself, that's your business. That won't stop me from asking questions, though. It's up to you whether you lie or not.
I think that goes both ways, doesn't it? Perrin responded. Well, you want my story straight? Fine. Here it is, Col. I'm a deserter from the Malazan army, ranked as captain. I also did a lot of work with the Claw, and looking back on it, that's where the trouble started. Anyway, it's done.
Oh, yes. And one more thing. People who get close to me usually end up dead, he thought to himself.
Col was silent, his eyes glittering in the firelight and fixed on the man opposite him. Then he puffed his cheeks and blew out a loud breath of air.
Truth as bald as that makes a challenge, don't it?
He stared into the fire, then leaned back on his elbows and lifted his face to the stars now appearing overhead.
I was once a noble in Darujistan, the last son of a long-lined, powerful family. I was set for an arranged marriage, but I fell in love with another woman, a hungry, ambitious woman, though I was blind to that.
He smiled wryly.
She was a whore, in fact. Only where most whores I've met are pretty down to earth. She was as twisted a soul as you could imagine.
He passed a hand across his eyes.
Anyway, I refuted my obligations and broke off the arranged marriage. It killed my father, I think, when I married Eistel. That was the whore's name, though she's changed it since.
He laughed harshly at the night sky.
Didn't take her long. I'm still not sure how she managed the details, how many men she took to bed to buy their influence, or how they did it. All I know is I woke up one day and found myself stripped of title, stripped even of my family name. The estate was hers, the money was hers, it was all hers, and her need for me had ended.
The flames licked the dry wood between them. Perrin said nothing. He sensed that more was to come from the man opposite him, and that Col was struggling with it.
But that wasn't the worst betrayal, Perrin, he said at length, meeting the captain's eyes. Oh, no. That came when I walked away from it. I could have fought her. I might even have won.
His jaw tautened, the only hint of anguish that escaped his self-control. Then he continued, in a flat, empty voice.
Acquaintances I had known for decades looked right through me. To everyone, I was dead. They chose not to hear me. They just walked past, or didn't even come to the gates of their estates when I called on them. I was dead, Perrin. Even the city's records claimed it. And so I agreed with them. I walked away, disappeared. It's one thing to have your friends mourn your passing in your face, but it's another to betray your own life, Perrin. But, as you said, it's done.
The captain looked away, squinting into the darkness. What's this human urge, he wondered, that brings us to such devastation?
The games of the Highborn, he said quietly, span the world. I was born a noble like you, Col. But in Malaz we'd met our match in the old Emperor. He crushed us at every turn until we cowered like whipped dogs. Cowered for years. But it was only an issue of power, wasn't it? He said, more to himself than to the man who shared the fire. There are no lessons worthy enough for a noble to heed. I look back on my years within that twisted, hungry company. I look back on that life now, Col, and I see it wasn't a life at all.
He was silent for a time. Then a slow smile curved his mouth.